Podcast, Monday, April 1st, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, it is April 1st, technically April Fool's Day, but I like to think of it more as the day Apple Computer was founded. Apple Computer was founded 37 years ago on April 1st, 1976, by Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, and Ron Wayne. And for those of you who are into your Apple history, Apple was actually incorporated almost a year later on January 3rd, 1977. But the founding was actually April 1st, 1976. So I'd like to say happy birthday to Apple. The other thing that I'll mention is I hate April Fool's Day when it comes to tech news. Very often, some of the stories that appear will seem to be real, only to turn out to be elaborate April Fool's hoaxes. And I'm not really sure. It seems to me in the news industry that the tech sector is one of those few places where it seems to be okay to report news on April 1st that is fake and sort of try and pass it off as real and get everybody to believe it. But I think it just leads to a lot of confusion and frustration on my part sometimes. So maybe it's only because I'm often targeted by that stuff. I fall for it. Okay, I'm gullible when it comes to certain stories and certain things. So I'll admit it. But to that end, I am not a big fan of doing that sort of thing. So there's going to be no April Fool's pranks in this episode of the MacCast. So you don't have to worry about that sort of thing. But we have a ton of really great, cool Mac news and Apple tips and hints and tricks to get to. But before we do that, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of our sponsors, and that's ShareFile by Citrix. You know, these days, most of your business emails are going to include some sort of attachment, a Word document, a spreadsheet, a PowerPoint, a Pages file, a PDF. Maybe you're sending contracts, whatever it might be. The thing is it's really important for you to know that the information gets to where you need it to go. It ends up in the right hands. It remains confidential and secure. And that doesn't always happen when you're just sending standard email attachments. And that's why ShareFile was created and why it's so important to your business. With ShareFile, you're not going to have to worry about emails getting bounced back, getting caught up in an email system, because it sends your attachments as secure links. That means you can send files of almost any size, you can do it with a high level of security because it's encrypted, and you can get notifications as to when your files have been opened, and you'll know by whom. So you know they're going to get where they need to go. And ShareFile is really easy to use and integrates right into your business. Plus, with ShareFile, you can access your files from anywhere. So you can get them on your laptop, on your PC, on your Mac, your tablet, your smartphone. You'll always have access to the files that you need. That's why I really recommend you give ShareFile a try. If you're not using ShareFile yet, all you need to do is sign up for my free trial now. There's no credit card required, so you really have nothing to lose, and you can see why millions of professionals rely on it every day. To get started today with my special 30-day free trial, just go to ShareFile.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter my promo code MACCAST. That's ShareFile.com, and type in my promo code MACCAST. And a big thank you to ShareFile and Citrix for their support of the MacCast. Remember back in October when Apple went through its executive shakeup? That was when Scott Forstall and John Browett were leaving the company, and then Tim Cook announced that they were going to restructure the upper tiers of management, sort of putting key executives in charge of multiple teams, overseeing different departments, and one of those changes was putting Johnny Ive in charge of all of Apple's design teams. not just hardware, but also the software design team. And what the hope was from many of us was that that meant there was going to be this tighter integration of the hardware design and the software design, bringing it all together. And IVE is now controlling both the industrial design team and the human interface teams. So we were really looking forward to seeing what the fruits of that were going to bear. And now the Wall Street Journal is reporting that insiders at Apple are beginning to notice actually some of the effects of those changes. They report that their sources say IVE is starting to appear regularly at the human interface design team's review sessions. They also claim that the human interface design team is being briefed about industrial prototypes earlier than they used to, whereas in the past, the hardware team would actually tap their own sort of stealth group of software developers to help with the prototypes. They're now including the industrial design team. So that's that sort of tighter integration of hardware and software. They're being brought into the process earlier. And I think ultimately that is going to really help the integration and the cohesiveness of Apple's designs, both on the inside and the outside. And another one of the things that many people were hoping for is that IVE would start to assert his influence on the iOS software designs, getting rid of some of that real-world kind of skeuomorphic, little flourishy kind of stuff. And it looks like that is starting to happen now. They do report that IVE is pushing for a more flat design, something that's starker, more simple. And to me, the move isn't too surprising, considering that we've heard for a while that IVE was never really a fan of that ornamental skeuomorphic design style, that that was reportedly being pushed by Steve Jobs and had been really supported by Scott Forstall, who was the iOS lead at the time. Now that things have changed, we've got Tim Cook in charge. It sounds like it's opened up and made way for some of that stuff to start to go away. And I know a lot of people are really happy about that. For those of you who don't know what that whole skeuomorphic thing is, examples would include that stitching and sort of torn paper edges that are in the calendar app. A really good example is the green felt game table motif that Apple uses inside Game Center. And those skeuomorphic designs started to become really heavily used in the iOS interfaces specifically. I guess that's probably because Forrestal was supporting that kind of style. And then it started to cross over when Apple started integrating more iOS in back into Mac OS X. So we see quite a bit of it in Mountain Lion. And I've personally also really never been much of a fan. I really don't like the stuff in Game Center. When I first started using Game Center, to me, it was very hard to figure out what to click on. Nothing looked like buttons. You know, everything was kind of print on felt, and I wasn't really sure, is that a background or is that actually something I need to interact with? And so I think that leads to a lot of confusion in the design. So I'm looking forward to seeing what Apple and IVE is going to have in store for sort of slowly undoing that skeuomorphic stuff. And it does look like that transition is going to be gradual and sort of subtle, at least according to the report coming out of the Wall Street Journal. But we may have received our sort of first hints of IVE's influence this week and are starting to see what I hope is a sign of things to come, at least with the latest update to Apple's podcast app. It was updated recently, and the first thing everybody noticed was that reel-to-reel tape interface that you would get to by swiping up on the album art, and that would give you access to the extra controls, like the speed controls and things like that, the chapter markers for enhanced podcasts. That is gone. And I think we're all happy to kind of see it go. Most of the controls have been moved into the main interface, and they have a flat look. They're right there on the main playback screen. And to me, I think it's a lot better because the controls are right there. They're more accessible. And they did it in a way that didn't make it overwhelming. I think one of the things that was maybe an advantage of having some of that stuff hidden away is it can simplify the main interface. But even now that all those controls have been brought to the forefront, they're there, they're discoverable. But I guess because they're not, you know, in-your-face kind of buttons, they're more flat elements that you can interact with, they don't really seem to be cumbersome, in my opinion. So I like the new design of the podcast app, and hopefully that influence is going to find its way into things like the calendar app, back into Game Center and what have you. So I think we're starting to see the hints of it, but Ive's influence on the software side now looks like it's finally starting to show up. For those of us who heard about it, I don't think we will soon forget about the infamous hack of Wired reporter Matt Honan's accounts. Hackers got in and hacked his Amazon, Google, and ultimately iCloud accounts, and used the iCloud information to turn around and erase all of the data on his Macs and his iOS devices. It was pretty horrific, and one of the ways that they got into his iCloud account was through being able to get enough information to call up Apple's support and get them to reset the passwords on his accounts, which was something that Apple would do for you if you had lost your password and couldn't get into your iCloud accounts. Well, this week, Apple took a big step into closing that hole and finally has enabled two-factor authentication on your Apple ID accounts. So you can now go in, you can enable two-factor authentication for accessing and making changes to your Apple ID. Basically, what happens is once you've enabled it, you will require an extra 4-digit code to gain access to be able to manage your Apple ID account and log in and change your password via Apple's ID website. The code is sent to you to an approved iOS device, or you can also use just any kind of phone with text messaging. In essence, you get a notification either through the Find My iPhone app or through text message that'll give you a code that you'll need to enter in as an additional proof that you actually are the person trying to access the account. The point of two-factor is that it requires not just login credentials, but also physical access to an object like an iPhone before allowing account changes to be made. So basically, your iDevice is acting almost like a physical key that you'd be putting into a lock. You're using a 4-digit code, but you kind of get the point. And even if someone got a hold of your login information, they would not be able to log in and change your password or access any of your personal information or send a wipe request to your iOS devices. The additional two-factor code is also required to make purchases on any new computer or device using your iTunes account. So you only have to do it once for each device, but if you logged into a new computer, you got a new device and tried to make a purchase, it's going to ask you to verify your Apple ID with that two-factor authentication. And in the case of closing up the hole that was used to hack Matt Honan, a big thing that happens once you've enabled two-factor authentication on your Apple ID is that Apple's representatives will no longer be able to reset your password. They will not be able to get in there. There is nothing they can do. So it's important to note that when you first set up two-factor authentication via the website, Apple's also going to supply you with a recovery key that they will tell you to print out and store in a secure location, because you'll require that as the second form of identification if you lose physical access to your device. So you're always going to need two forms of identification, either your username and password and the security code from an approved device, an approved device and your recovery key, your username and password and your recovery key. I think you kind of get the point, but you're going to need at least two, or they're not going to let you go in and modify anything on your account, and that would include resetting your password. So if you lose all those things and you're using two-factor, you're pretty much out of luck at that point. You're just going to have to stop using your account and create a new one. So it sounds a little bit scary sometimes, but the odds of you losing all of that information are pretty slim if you just take good measures and steps to protect it. And we're going to talk about how to do all that. And I set up two-factor on my accounts. I would encourage anybody to do it. And I'll go walk you through the process here in the tips and feedback portion of the show in a minute. So in addition to enabling two-factor on your Apple ID this week, Apple also updated their app pages on the App Store to now indicate when an application has an in-app purchase element associated with it. Now, it seems like this is a response to a couple of high-profile incidents recently, many of them out of the UK, where kids racked up large amounts of in-app purchases on supposedly free games. I guess what happened is at some point the parents typed in their Apple ID or their iTunes ID username and password, maybe to make a purchase of an additional game, something like that. But at that point, that window kicks in where you can make additional purchases without having to reauthorize. And then at that point, the kids rack up huge in-app purchase bills. And of course, here in the States, because of the problems with in-app purchases, there was a class action lawsuit, and Apple recently had to settle that lawsuit, and the update for the App Store may also be a result of that action. It's not really clear. But regardless, there's now a new offers in-app purchases text that appears under the star ratings and next to the purchase button on the stores. So it's now very clear which applications have in-app purchases. I don't know that that's going to go a long way to preventing kids from making in-app purchases without their parents' knowledge. So I also covered recently on the MacCast how you can use the restrictions feature, or basically the parental controls in your iOS devices, to completely lock out in-app purchases. And I would encourage any parent who's going to be handing off their device to their children to enable that feature. All that means is that if you want to make an in-app purchase with that enabled, you are going to have to enter a passcode for your device. So when you set up the restrictions on your iOS device, you're asked to enter a 4-digit code. You put that code in, and that'll just be required to bypass those restrictions. So it's a little less convenient, but if it prevents you from getting thousands and thousands of dollars of unwanted in-app purchases, I think that's a good thing to enable. So you might consider doing that. But a couple security and protective updates for Apple products this week. It's been rumored for a while now that when Apple releases or announces its next update to the iPhone, possibly early this summer, that they may also reveal a new lower-cost iPhone that's targeted at price-conscious consumers and emerging markets, something to compete with those lower-cost Android phones that are out there. And one of the main arguments against that so far has been that Apple generally likes to keep a pretty good profit margin on their devices, somewhere in the 30 to 40% range, actually more toward that 40% side of that scale. And that could ultimately prove pretty hard to do when you're just driving the price down and competing purely at that level. So it was kind of hard to swallow that Apple would put out a low-cost iPhone where they might potentially have a pretty thin margin, at least by Apple standards. And as a matter of fact, I think Phil Schiller came out at one point and said Apple is not going to do a quote-unquote cheaper iPhone. Well, this week we have at least one source that now believes that a low-cost iPhone doesn't necessarily have to come with a low margin. As a matter of fact, he thinks Apple might be able to maintain very close to its existing profit margins that it likes to maintain. An analyst for Credit Suisse this week said that he believes Apple will target a price point of about $329 US unsubsidized for the new lower cost iPhone, but that with that price point, they could still build in about a 38% margin. Just how Apple will actually hit the lower price point and maintain that healthy margin wasn't really covered by the report, but we had been hearing rumors that Apple would use a lower cost plastic, maybe plastic and fiberglass kind of case. They might use some of the same components that they've been using so far for other devices, specifically the Retina screen, the 4-inch Retina screen that's in the current iPhone 5. Another one of those cost-cutting measures that Apple might employ would be to release the phone as a 3G-only device, and they would not have LTE support built in. That one, in my opinion, would be a really bad idea. I think all of the competing smartphones are sort of moving toward LTE. Maybe it's not so critical for those emerging markets, but I think if you're going to release a device in the major markets, that Apple's going to have, even on the lower price point, an LTE-style device. But if they can find those ways to cut the cost and still maintain that healthy margin, I think that adds a lot more stock to the rumors of Apple doing a new lower-cost phone, sort of expanding their existing iPhone lineup and reaching, again, some of those markets that they haven't been able to reach yet with those existing devices. And that'll overall, I think, help sales. And the current rumors continue to point to a third quarter launch for the iPhone 5S. So sometime this summer, probably an announcement around June, maybe a release date in July. DigiTimes says that suppliers are expected to start shipping components for new devices sometime in May. The iPhone 5S is also expected to be mostly internal updates, so not a lot of big sweeping design changes. It's expected to have a faster processor, maybe a higher megapixel camera, and will very likely have the same form factor with the 4-inch screen size. Some are still holding out hope for a 4.5, 4.7-inch screen, maybe something just slightly wider, but I think it's probably going to maintain exactly the same shape and form factor as the current iPhone. But we should find out in just a couple months here. Most people are expecting some sort of announcement sometime around June. Apple's been working for a few years now at reducing their environmental footprint, and last week, they announced that they had achieved 100% renewable energy at all of their data centers, which is a pretty significant milestone. They say that their facilities in North Carolina, Austin, Elk Grove, Cork, Munich, and even their data centers on the campus at Infinite Loop in Cupertino are now all powered by 100% renewable energy. As a matter of fact, the facility in Maiden, North Carolina has a 100-acre solar farm that's said to be the largest private one in America, and that was just completed last December. The facility also uses that along with biogas fuel cells from Bloom Technologies to produce about 60% of the facility's energy needs on site. They get the rest of the power, I believe, from renewable sources in the community. Apple also claimed that worldwide, all of their operations currently use about 75% of renewable energy sources, and that they continue to work toward making that number 100% at sometime in the future. Apple has been continually working to try and improve their widely criticized Maps application. I think we've actually seen things improve pretty quickly since Tim Cook came out publicly and admitted that Apple had a problem with the Maps application and that they would be working hard to resolve the problems. We've seen several updates and improvements to the Maps, including things like flyover and fixing some of the issues that were being reported. One thing when that was all happening that I was exposed to was several of the MacCast listeners work in mapping and in cartography, and they emailed me to say that one of the best things that Apple could possibly do to improve maps would be to actually get real people involved from the various local regions where they were having problems, people that could go in and go over issues, people who were more importantly familiar with the geography and the regions and could sort of vet that data by hand, go in and correct issues. Well, this week it looks like that is exactly what Apple is doing. Apple recently posted open positions for what they're calling Ground Truth Managers in 7 different countries. They're looking for people in the U.S., in Eastern and Western Europe, Japan, in Asia Pacific, the rest of the Americas, and also the Middle East and Africa. Apple had previously hired Maps Ground Truth Managers just in Australia. That was where some of the first and sort of most public criticisms came over the map data. And they have been working very hard, I know, to resolve issues in that region. Many of you who live in that area have emailed to tell me that things are getting better. And so I think that proves that having ground truth managers, or actually physical people who know the area working on these maps, can really help improve the information. And according to the postings, people hired into these positions are going to test new releases of the mapping code with data from the local region. They're going to collect additional data that will let them analyze and look at the impact of the potential map code or data changes relative to what information they have about the local region. They can use their expertise to provide feedback and specific details that will need to go into the map. So like specific, I would assume, historical locations, points of interest, that sort of stuff. When, you know, if you live in an area, you know, like when a new road goes in, right? That maybe not, that might not be on the satellite data, or might not be on older data, or, you know, alternate routes, or, hey, they, you know, this road actually got changed recently. They rerouted it or added an additional lane or something like that. And only someone local in the region is going to know that kind of information, so they can use that local expertise. They can also take competing products, other maps and other data from that region, and compare it to the data that Apple has acquired from various sources, and compare and contrast those things and make adjustments as well. So all of that stuff is going to lend itself to making a better mapping system. And they're basically relying on these local regional experts on the ground, and not just using and relying on these data sets and the satellite data and all the information that they purchased from all these various sources. And that was another one of those things that was pointed out as a potential problem, was Apple had acquired data from a bunch of different locations to try and get their data sets up to speed and in line with, say, what Google had been collecting over years and years. And in doing that, they had a big challenge of putting that data together and getting it all to match up and to make sense. So sounds like this is really going to help with that effort. And Apple also may be looking to expand its mapping efforts, not just outside, but also move that inside into inner spaces. According to the Wall Street Journal, they've confirmed through an Apple spokesman that Apple acquired the indoor GPS startup Wi-Fi Slam. Apple declined to comment specifically on the deal or say why they had acquired the company, but according to the Wall Street Journal, they say the deal was worth about $20 million US, and they think it's a move by Apple to actually remain competitive in the mapping space against Google. Google actually already has an indoor mapping solution, and they've been mapping certain locations like airports and shopping centers and sports venues. And so Wi-Fi Slam's technology could help Apple move into that space and compete. Specifically, the technology and API that they offer to developers allows for mobile applications to detect a phone user's location within a building using the Wi-Fi signals, and the system works in real time, they say, up to a 2.5 meter accuracy using just ambient Wi-Fi signals. And the technology is designed to map indoor spaces and also provide new types of retail and social networking experiences within those apps. They can do things like do step-by-step indoor navigation. They can do proximity-based social networking, and they can also provide product-level retail customer engagement. I'm assuming that means, that's their marketing term, I'm assuming what that means is you could, in, say, a shopping center, you could move toward a specific product or an area of products and then start to get information or maybe coupons related to those products while you're walking around indoors, which could be pretty cool. There's some pretty cool applications. But supposedly also the Wi-Fi Slam technology could be used to construct indoor maps, and that may be part of the reason why Apple wants it. It could also just be that Apple wants the engineers. You've got, even though it's a small company, I would imagine you have some very talented people in the areas of Wi-Fi and mapping, two things that Apple could use, always use help with. So interesting acquisitions, but certainly Apple striving to continue to improve their maps. And I think they've done a great job of ramping up very, very quickly. And I was never, as you know, miffed by Apple's maps. I always thought they were pretty good. And I personally have been using them now for several months. I use the turn-by-turn stuff, and at least in my region where I am, it works great. And from many of you, the reports I've asked for and people emailing me back and commenting, most of you have said you're pretty happy with Apple's mapping solution so far. So it sounds like it's just getting better. Great news this week for T-Mobile fans in the U.S. T-Mobile announced that it will finally be selling the iPhone 5. That's going to start up here on April 12th. They're going to be doing it a little bit differently, though, because they no longer are doing subsidized contract plans. It's really only slightly different, in my opinion, versus other carriers. But basically, the way it's going to work is they'll sell you an iPhone for $100 up front. That's for the 16-gigabyte iPhone 5, along with a calling and data plan. But that plan does not require a contract. So you're going to pay the upfront cost of $100. Then you're going to get your calling and data plan. And then on top of that, you'll pay $20 a month for your phone for the next 24 months until you pay off the device. So the upfront cost is $100 for the 16-gigabyte model. 32-gigabyte and 64-gigabyte iPhone 5s are $200 and $300 respectively for the upfront cost. And then you have that $20 a month cost on top of it for 24 months afterwards. So the total net cost that you'll end up with for a 16-gigabyte iPhone 5 on T-Mobile is going to be about $580 US, which is actually a pretty good savings over what you'd pay if you went into the Apple Store and just purchased a purely unlocked device. 16-gigabyte iPhone 5 unlocked from Apple right now costs $649 US. Now, you do have to have a T-Mobile calling and data plan. Their call and data plan is $50 a month US for unlimited talk, text, and data. But be careful, it sounds really good. You have to read the fine print, though. Only the first 500 megabytes of data is on the 4G network. And at that point, after you use that up, it'll switch over to their slower data network, which is probably going to be about edge speeds. If you want more 4G data, you of course have to pay a little bit more. It's $10 per month per line if you want a 2 gigabyte limit. If you want to jump up to the higher tier 4 gigabyte limit, that's going to run you an additional $20 a month. So in the end, I think all the costs end up being fairly close to an on-contract plan. The big deal here is that you're not having a contract, so you can get out of it at any time. The thing is you're still going to have to pay off the phone. So if you leave early before paying your $20 a month for 24 months, you're going to have to make up the difference get out of the T-Mobile plan. So I don't know how that doesn't have you still, in essence, on a contract, but I guess if we call it a payment plan and don't use the word early termination fee, it is different in some sort of way. If someone could explain it to me more concisely than that, then let me know. But T-Mobile does have a couple other benefits when it comes to the iPhone 5. They're going to be the first U.S. carrier to offer the HD voice feature, and their plans will also include 500 megabytes of 4G tethering included with the plan. So AT&T also did announce just today, I think, that they are going to be supporting HD voice. That's the wideband audio. It's a hardware feature that's built into the iPhone 5, but it needed carrier support. I think it has support on some carriers outside the U.S., but T-Mobile will be the first U.S. carrier to support it, and then AT&T said they are going to be supporting it later this year. They didn't give an exact date. The other thing to note with moving to T-Mobile in the States is that while they have a pretty large 4G network, their LTE coverage is pretty limited at this point. They're in 7 cities so far: Baltimore, Houston, Kansas City, Las Vegas, Phoenix, San Jose, and Washington, D.C. New York is expected to get LTE coverage for T-Mobile sometime later this summer, and they are working on expanding that LTE coverage, I think, through the end of the year. I can't remember exactly how many cities they say that they're going to have online. As far as how fast their 4G network is, they use the 3G HSPA Plus network, similar to AT&T, so you get 21 megabits per second down. They do support 42 megabit per second HSPA Plus in some markets, but the iPhone 5 currently doesn't support those download speeds. So you're going to be on the 21 megabit per second, even in those markets where they do offer faster 42 megabit per second speeds. And that's, again, similar to AT&T, so there's really not a lot of differences there. An unlocked AT&T iPhone should work on the T-Mobile network, though, according to Macworld. That's the GSM-based A1428 model. So if you have that model and you have it unlocked from AT&T and you want to move over to T-Mobile when they come online here in a week or so, then you should be able to do that. Many of you know that last week Apple released iOS update 6.1.3, but according to CNET, it seems like some users are now complaining of issues on their iOS devices after running Apple's latest update. The update was released specifically to address a security issue that had allowed an attacker with physical access to the device to potentially bypass the lock screen and gain access to things like the phone application, the contacts, and the camera roll. A support forum thread has users now complaining that after applying the update, they're seeing reduced battery life. The standard fixes, according to the reports, don't seem to be correcting the issue, doing things like adjusting the wireless or Bluetooth settings, resetting the device, or even restoring the device don't seem to help. Additionally, some users are reporting that they have Wi-Fi connectivity issues as well as the battery drain, and also some users are reporting seeing battery drain issues when connecting to Microsoft Exchange servers. Both the Wi-Fi connectivity issues and the Microsoft Exchange bugs supposedly had been patched in earlier updates to iOS prior to iOS 6.1, so it's a little confusing as to what's happening here. It looks like maybe some of these bugs have been reintroduced. I personally have noticed that my iOS devices seem to be getting slightly less battery life after applying the updates, although nothing to me has caused significant concern. It hasn't been that much different, just slightly reduced, I would say, in maybe the 10 to 15% range in my experience so far. So I don't know. Hopefully, if these issues are legit, Apple addresses them pretty quickly and we'll see another update. We have seen instances in the past where Apple has pushed out a new update and accidentally reintroduced what seems like older bugs. So maybe that's what's going on here. I don't know if you've had any kind of similar experiences with reduced battery life after applying the 6.1.3 update. Another week's gone by, and we have another report of Apple moving further and further away from Samsung as their supplier. NPD Group's display research said that Apple plans to move their display contracts for the next generation iPad mini away from Samsung. This comes via the Taipei Times, who's reporting that the contracts will go to the Taiwanese firm Innolux and also some contracts to China's Century Display. Innolux actually already supplies panels for the full-size iPad, and they recently announced that they would begin shipping smartphone and tablet displays with their touch-on-display technology. That should happen by the end of this year. And this report would seem to back up a similar report made by Digitimes, although they claim that iPad mini display production is being moved to LG Display, Sharp, Japan Display, and AU Optronics. Digitimes is also reporting that Apple is reducing current iPad mini orders for the second quarter. This is so that they can slow current gen production in advance of an update to start shipping in the third quarter. The current belief is that Apple will start selling a second generation iPad mini with a high resolution Retina display sometime in the fall. I promised you that there would be no April Fool's jokes in this episode, so remember that when I start to tell you this next story, because it's going to sound like a joke, but unfortunately, it isn't. The latest rumor on Apple's fabled TV set, again coming from Digitimes, is that now the Phantom TV will be a 4K set. What is 4K, you ask? Well, it's the latest generation marketing buzz spec from the HD TV industry. It's also known as Ultra HD or Ultra High Definition. It can mean one of two different resolutions, 3840 by 2160 pixels or 4096 by 2160 pixels. Basically, it's meant to be about four times the resolution of current 1080p technology, which is 1920 by 1080 resolution. The Digitimes report also says that Apple's new television will have internet support and voice and motion control. As cool as 4K technology sounds, there are several things that in my mind make this not a viable rumor whatsoever. The first is, while 4K was huge at CES this year, it is currently uber expensive. It's not shipping, and most of the panels that we saw at CES were huge, 80 inches or larger. The reason? Well, the Mac Observer talked to representatives from the television companies at CES, and they say that the experts they spoke with explained that smaller sizes can be made, but that our eyes literally can't detect the higher quality images at the smaller screen sizes. That's not going to stop the TV industry from putting out 4K sets, though. They've announced that later this year they should have sets shipping in about the 55-inch to 60-inch range, although prices are set at $35,000 to $40,000. So I don't think Apple's going to be putting out a $35,000 Apple TV. Another reason why Apple might not want to rush an Apple TV set out in 4K yet is that while many TV shows and movies are currently being shot in 4K, there really isn't a system to actually distribute or get the content to consumers. Blu-ray may eventually get 4K through a new codec, but that codec hasn't even been ratified yet. And as far as any hope of getting 4K content through your cable provider, well, I'll just tell you the bandwidth is not there. The pipes are not big enough yet. We are not ready for it. And to me, that says that Apple isn't ready to deliver a television that is going to give us that technology. So where exactly does that leave this rumor? I would say that for Apple, it's probably firmly in the prototyping and exploring camp. I think there's good odds that maybe an Apple 4K TV set does exist, but it's probably just in a lab somewhere. And I would almost guarantee that it will not release either late in 2013 or early in 2014, like the Digitimes report is claiming. Seeming almost as far-fetched as that, Pocket Gamer this week claimed that Apple was allegedly meeting with developers at the annual Game Developers Conference to discuss a new game controller the company is reportedly working on. The site claimed that Apple reportedly booked a room at the trade show under a fake name to avoid any press tip-offs. Now, from my very first reading of this story, it seemed a little bit far-fetched. To me, I don't think Apple wants to get into making a joystick, whatever you want to call it, any kind of gaming controller. But there have been rumors of Apple working on a project to bring a physical game controller to market in the past. Last year, Anantech said Apple was working on something like that. Now, the latest rumor, this one from Pocket Gamer, was all but shut down, though, when the unofficial vetter of all Apple rumors, Jim the Beard Dalrymple, simply responded on his blog by saying, nope. And that's pretty much a definitive answer. The Loop and Jim Dalrymple are pretty much the gospel when it comes to validating or invalidating any kind of Apple rumors. And then finally, The Verge this week said Apple's long-rumored streaming music radio service may have finally made some forward movement. According to the site, significant progress has been made in deals with at least two of the top labels, Universal and Warner. They have a source saying that there was no doubt that iRadio was coming. Apple has supposedly been pushing very, very hard to get the project out for a summer release. Last time, I think I told you about a New York Times piece that claimed Apple was working with the labels, but that they were at odds because Apple wanted to pay well below what they considered to be the industry standard royalty rate of 12 cents per 100 streams. That's actually about half of what Apple supposedly had offered. Pandora pays the 12-cent rate, and currently Spotify pays as much as 35 cents for 100 streams. So a 6-cent deal for Apple would be killer. The big change that we're hearing about now is that Spotify has their deal up for renewal and has been pushing really, really hard to get better rates. Pandora has also historically been pretty aggressive about keeping the rates down. So the thought is at this point, the industry may be willing to do a deal with Apple and iTunes because the iTunes behemoth could bring a little more juice to the bidding war and put the competition against each other, kind of keeping the whole marketplace a little bit healthier. Of all the rumors that we just went over, I think that this one is the one that has the most likelihood of becoming true. Apple has been working on this service from what we've been hearing for a long, long time. And it sounds like the music industry might be finally willing to deal, at least according to this latest report. So it really wouldn't surprise me if we heard an announcement from Apple about a new streaming music service. As to whether or not it'll happen this summer, I think Apple's going to have to push really, really hard to make that happen just based on the volume of rumors we've heard so far. But I don't put it outside the realm of possibility. Maybe we'll hear an announcement of a service coming at WWDC and have it launch sometime probably in the fall with their iTunes Now iPad Mini / music event. So stay tuned for that. I know there's a lot of people really looking forward to an iTunes streaming music service. We may actually end up getting it sometime this year. We've heard for a while now that Apple runs the iTunes store basically as a break-even proposition. Well, this week, a piece on All Things D claims that iTunes is now doing a little bit more than just breaking even. So what's the change? Well, they cite the addition of Apple's own apps sold through its app stores as a major contributor to the recent uptick in iTunes profits. Their numbers come from a Simcoe, which is estimating that Apple's apps, things like iWork and the iLife Suite, as well as Final Cut Pro, Aputure, etc., those are all contributing about $3.6 billion in sales to Apple's 2012 iTunes revenues. And that's good because they're saying margins on things like music and videos and book sales, the stuff traditionally sold through iTunes, those are relatively low, somewhere in like the single digits. But for things like software, the margins are generally better, more in the 50% range. And so that means Apple's making more money off that stuff. In the report, Asimco believes that with Apple's software added into iTunes, they're now generating as much as 15% operating margin on top of the gross revenue. So with their 2012 revenues at about $13.5 billion, that would result in iTunes adding about $2 billion to Apple's bottom line, and I'd say that's not bad for just a break-even business. If you're a listener to the show, chances are you probably know it's no secret that I'm not the biggest fan of the freemium app model in the iOS App Store, but I actually also don't deny why freemium apps with in-app purchase are becoming the way of the future for app sales, as frustrating as I actually find it. I really wish that developers could just sell their apps for what the app is worth and that we wouldn't have to have these kind of what I really see as almost tricks, not nefarious tricks, but little tricks to get us to pay what an app is actually worth. I'd rather just see us pay that up front. But the numbers came in this week from the analytics firm Distimo, and they say that in looking at February iPhone app sales, 71% of iPhone sales revenue actually came via in-app purchases made on free apps. About 24% of actual app revenues came directly from app sales, with the remaining revenue coming from in-app purchases on paid apps. So I think despite whatever I might think or despite whatever I think consumers might want, I think those kinds of numbers are going to continue to grow, and they're going to continue to show that more and more consumers are willing to opt for a free app with in-app purchase before they're willing to shell out money purely for paying for the app up front. And as frustrating as that might be to me, I think reports like this definitely demonstrate that consumers have made their choice. I'll just make my last plea to developers. If you do go the in-app purchase route, do the thing where you offer a, I don't know what you call it, a full unlock, but basically getting access to all of the features of the application for one set price. That's a basically giving us our cake and letting us eat it too. That way, people who want to buy in-app features a la carte, maybe one at a time, have their option. Those of us who would prefer just to pay you $10, $15 for your application, we can do that all in one fell swoop and get an app that's not essentially crippled until we pay up a little bit more and a little bit more. I don't like this sort of minimalistic payment bleeding option that some apps end up with. I completely understand it. I just don't want it. If you use the Messages app and Apple's iMessage service, and let's be honest, who doesn't? This next story is going to be a little bit frightening to you. This week, several jailbreak developers were targeted by a denial of service attack against their iMessage accounts and the Messages app. The bad thing about this attack is that it's surprisingly simple to execute. There's little to nothing the victim can do to stop it, and it has absolutely nothing to do with jailbreaking. This isn't just one of those things where, oh, you jailbreak, so you're at risk. You can get hit with this even on a factory clean device if you use Messages and iMessage. The trouble is rooted in a flaw in Apple's iMessage service, which will allow it to happily deliver messages as fast as they are sent without any throttling limits being in place. Basically, what happened was the attackers used this fact to flood the victim's iMessage account with things like messages, text messages, Unicode strings, basically anything that would flood the system and then ultimately render their Messages app completely useless. It was just overloaded. They couldn't launch the Messages app on their device, and they couldn't stop the messages from flooding in. Actually, the only recourse they had was to simply completely disable the use of iMessages and the Messages app completely. The problem was also compounded by the fact that iMessages use email addresses to set up the connections. So anyone who knows or can find out your email address or the email address assigned to your iMessage account could potentially use that to target you with this attack. Now, the simple thing for Apple to do to fix this would be to, one, put throttles in place or temporarily block IPs that send messages at rates above any kind of threshold that they have set. They could also provide a way for the end user, the person receiving messages, to actually block a sender, something that we currently can't do. And or they could allow us to say, you know what, I only want to get iMessages from specific senders or groups. Say, for example, I only want to allow messages to come in from people who are in my address book. So if the email address isn't in my address book, I don't want to receive messages from that person. And yes, I know that things like IP addresses for blocking IPs and email addresses and things like that, those things can be spoofed. But at least if some of those control mechanisms were in place, we would have a little bit more protection and our risk would be somewhat reduced. And my only hope is that now that Apple is aware of the seriousness of the security hole in the iMessage system, that they're going to work pretty quickly to actually patch it up. It would actually be pretty easy for them to just put some rate throttling measures in place on the servers so that you can't just simply overwhelm somebody with a bunch of messages. You can kind of trickle them in, you know, one every few seconds or so should be plenty fast enough for most people, unless you're one of those crazy fast texters, but I don't think most of us do that. And then lastly in the news for this week, in case you missed it, Sunday was World Backup Day. And you know I'm a huge backup fanatic. And so I'm not going to hound you. I'm just going to leave you with this. If you aren't backing up yet, it's time to start. And there's three different ways that I would say you could do it. The simplest one, go out, buy an external USB drive, connect it to your Mac, and when it pops up and says, do you want to enable Time Machine for this drive? Just say yes. That is simple, straightforward. If you don't do anything else, I beg of you. Okay, so I lied earlier. I am going to plead with you. I beg of you, just do that. Another thing you could do, go out, buy an external USB drive, connect it, and purchase an application like SuperDuper, Carbon Copy Cloner, something where you could make a bootable clone of your internal hard drive, set that up, and run that. The third thing you could do, subscribe to a service, an online backup service, something like CrashPlan, which is my personal favorite, but you can pick any of them that you like. I don't really care. I'm not beholden to one or the other. Download their software, run it, set it up, configure it, and go about the rest of your lives knowing that you are secure and safe and that you have at least one form of backup in place. You should ultimately do all three and mix and match and get a bunch of other, but at the very least, for World Backup Day, and I'm just going to call it World Backup Month, do one of those things. And then I will be very happy because I won't get the email from you asking me for a recommendation on recovery software or a recovery service. So there you have it. That is the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that is Squarespace. You know, if you need to build a website and you want it to be quick and easy and painless, you should really check out Squarespace. They have a beautiful and intuitive website publishing platform. It lets anyone easily create a professional looking web page, a blog, a photo gallery. You can do it all on a single platform. And actually, if you need e-commerce, they now have that built into the software as well. So you can sell digital products, you can sell physical items, all from your website, all using a single integrated platform. And they make it so easy to get started. You sign up for your account and immediately you have access to these amazing templates. They're all built by an award-winning design team and vetted by user experience experts, so you know that they're going to work really well. And all you have to do is add in your content. You throw in your images, you add your text. If you're selling products, you put your products in there. You could even hook up your social media accounts. And so in minutes, you're going to have an amazing looking website and you don't have to worry about load. They handle the hosting, so it's going to scale. If you get slash dotted, is that still a thing? If that happens to you, it's going to be able to handle it. You don't have to worry about it. And building your website is really just the beginning because they actually also provide real-time analytics. They have award-winning 24/7 support. And plus, if you sign up for a year, you get a free domain name. So what could be better? What? Well, how about a free trial? You can try it for free. Don't even have to do anything other than sign up. So just go to squarespace.com/maccast now. There's no credit card required. You can just jump in. You can start building your site. And when you decide to purchase, if you use the offer code MACCAST3, you're going to get 10% off your first purchase on a new account. And that includes both monthly and annual plans. So that's squarespace.com/maccast. Use the offer code MACCAST3. Sign up. It's awesome. Squarespace, they have everything you need to create an exceptional website, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. Every once in a while, we get a topic or a question on the MacCast that triggers an ongoing conversation, and it's really great. It's one of the reasons I started this show, was to kind of have this community back and forth. And most recently, we've been talking about this issue. I had a listener write in and he wanted to know about sharing content between two different accounts on the same Mac. So wanted a place where he could store files and both accounts could read and write to those files. And as it turned out, you would think something that sounds relatively simple, well, that ended up being pretty complicated. And we've offered up a couple different solutions. But this week I got this suggestion from Andrew.
Hi, Adam. This is Andrew from Penistone in Yorkshire in the UK. Over the last couple of Maccasts, you've been discussing how to share files across multiple logins on your Mac, and I thought I'd share with you the solution that myself and my wife use. We have basically harnessed the power of Dropbox to share files within a Mac and also between our Macs. So we have three Dropbox accounts, one for my business, one for my wife's university work, and one that's more of a general home family thing for kind of those sort of household things and other bits and pieces. But on one of those, we created a quick share folder, we call it, and we shared that folder using Dropbox with all three accounts. So now, whichever account you're logged into or whoever's working on it, if they drop something into the quick share folder, it auto magically Dropbox style appears in all the other accounts and all the other user ID logins. We go one step further because we both have MacBook Pros, and so those same files, whether in quick share, obviously the regular Dropbox way, will also appear on the logins on our laptops. So that's just another idea. I know it will use a bit of bandwidth and you'll have to restrict the size of files that you are sharing, but it's for quick and easy sharing. It really works for us. Anyway, keep up the good work. Take care. Bye now.
Hey, Andrew, thanks. I think that is a great suggestion, almost a perfect one, in fact, except for one small thing. I love Dropbox. I think that is the way I would likely go because it's just so convenient. It's so easy to set up. But the one thing it will do is make two copies of the same file. Now, it's going to keep them in sync, but you're going to end up with multiple copies on the same Mac. And I think this listener was trying to avoid that by having a single shared location where both people could access the same file and read write to it. But I think there's no real disadvantage, especially these days with hard drive sizes the way they are, unless you're working on massive, massive files. But I think this was mostly just small documents and things like that you might share within a family. I don't see an issue in using Dropbox. And like you said, there is going to be a little bit of bandwidth used up. It's not going to be instantaneous, but you're not going to be necessarily logged in and accessing both accounts at the same time, I guess, unless you're using something like the screen sharing feature, where someone can actually be logged into one account in the background while somebody else is working on that machine with the same account. But I would go the Dropbox route because I just frankly love Dropbox and it's simple and easy to set up. So I really appreciate the recommendation. And I think we've covered this topic just in about, I think that sort of rounds out and completes the discussion. I don't know, maybe some of you have more to add. If you know of another way to share files between multiple user accounts on the same Mac, please send in your feedback. We still welcome your comments and we'll keep the conversation going as long as you have something to add. So next thing that I want to talk about is something we covered on the last show. I had a call from Lisa who was unable, like many others, because there's some long discussion threads on this, to get an external HDMI connected monitor working correctly with her Mac Mini that has an HDMI port. So the issue is going HDMI out on the Mac Mini to HDMI in on the monitor, and a lot of people are reporting that when they do that, they get poor images, sort of static and flickering and all kinds of display issues on that display. And she was looking for a solution or trying to find a workaround or wanting to know if there was a fix for this. And unfortunately, I didn't have any information for her, so I asked you to send in your feedback. And actually, Bill wrote in to say he experienced exactly the same issues as you did, Lisa. He was having the same kinds of problems. And what he ultimately ended up doing to work around it was just used a different connection on the monitor. So most monitors these days, they might have HDMI in, but very likely they also have a digital connector, like, say, a DVI connection, something like that. And he ended up going and using the HDMI to DVI adapter that came with his Mac Mini, and then just connecting that to the DVI connection with a DVI cable to his monitor. And he said for that, that cleared up the image for him. So he was able to do that. He doesn't like having adapters, and I'm the same way, Bill. I don't like having adapters either, so he ended up buying an HDMI to DVI cable, which also worked. And I actually do the opposite thing with my Mac Mini going to a television set. So I have it hooked up from the DVI connector on my Mac Mini going to the HDMI in port on my TV set, and that works beautifully as well. So you might consider using just a different connection. Now, Bill did note that if you're going to go that route, you want to make sure that your cables meet the VESA and DisplayPort task group specifications. You can do that by ensuring that you have the DisplayPort logo on the packaging for your cables. Basically, what you need to ensure is that it uses the correct pinouts, because I guess some of the cheaper cables reportedly don't use correct pinouts, and that might also cause problems. Personally, I recommend Monoprice for buying cables, monoprice.com. They have low cost but very high quality cables, so you can kind of get the best of both worlds by going through them. And I really do find it unfortunate, Lisa, that I have to recommend to you that you use an adapter or a different cable, that you're not able to use the HDMI functionality that is on your Mac Mini to plug into an HDMI-based monitor. And I really don't know why that issue exists. Hopefully, Apple is aware of the issue at this point, because there is these ongoing discussion threads, and they work to address the issue, hopefully with some sort of software or firmware update. I'm really wondering, to a certain degree, if some of the issues may or may not be being caused by HDMI being encumbered by the HDCP DRM technologies that are pushed forward through, the movie industry wanting to close up any kind of digital or cable hole that might exist. And I know that the specifications, if they're not implemented correctly on both sides, or if the software is not up to date in both ways, maybe that's contributing or causing some of the issues. I'm purely speculating at this point, and probably in some ways pointing fingers, but I just hate DRM, and I have to wonder if that's not maybe some of the source of this HDMI stuff. Because I've had my own issues with hooking up HDMI monitors and what have you. Specifically, computer monitors seem to be more susceptible to these HDMI problems. I haven't had too many issues going into like an HDMI connector on a television set. So I don't know if you've tried that. Lisa, I think maybe you did tell me that in an email, but that might be another thing to test out to see if this is only going to an HDMI capable computer monitor, or if it matters the kind of display you're actually connecting it up to. But thanks, Bill, for sending in your suggestion. I'm pretty sure that route will work. I told you earlier that Apple has finally enabled two-factor authentication for your Apple ID, and I really would encourage you to consider enabling it. And so I thought I'd walk you through basically what you need to do, how you set it up, where you need to go to turn it on and to start using it. So the first thing you need to do is you need to go to Apple's ID management website. So if you go to appleid.apple.com, you go there, you'll see a button that says Manage Your Apple ID. Click on that and go ahead and enter your current login credentials. And once you've logged in, it's going to show you a screen. And on the left, you're going to look for the password and security option. Click that. And then over on the right-hand side, kind of near the top, you should see a new two-step verification option. It'll explain what two-step authentication and verification is. And then you can click the little Get Started link there. Now, if you've made any recent changes to your account, say like in the past 48 hours or something like that, it may tell you that you can't change your information for, I think, 3 days. And it'll say, we'll remind you to come back and update your information, but it'll send you an email to verify that you're trying to access and change your account. And then after a couple days, you'll be able to come back in here to the same website and actually enable two-factor authentication. But if you don't see that, if you click the little Get Started link under the two-factor section, it will start to walk you through the process. So the first thing that'll pop up is it'll pop up a message explaining the service and some of its benefits. on that screen, you can click read that stuff and then click the continue button. On the next page, it's going to give you a page of warnings. Seems a little bit scary at first, but don't be afraid. I think when I walk you through the process, you'll see it's relatively easy. But basically what they're warning you about is that you're going to need at least two forms of identification from the point you enable two-factor authentication moving forward in order to be able to access and make changes to your account. And that's actually a good thing. That's what you want, because you don't want somebody to be able to just, you know, somehow get access to your username or password, or actually just guess that, run it through, you know, a cracking algorithm or something like that. Just having that, once you've enabled the two-factor authentication, is not going to enable them to get in. They're going to need to have some other form of identification. So that's either going to be a trusted device, being like your iPhone or your phone, or the recovery key that Apple's going to provide you during the process. So you'll need the trusted device and the recovery key to reset your password if you've forgotten it. And that's really important, because once you've enabled this, Apple is not going to be able to reset your password. So it's warning you of that as well. But click through the warning screen, and then there'll be one last screen. They're going to want you to confirm that you want to go through the process of enabling two-factor authentication. And on here, it's going to show you a couple of images that show you the procedure that you'll go through to log in once two-factor is turned on. So on that screen, you can either continue or you can say no thanks as your sort of final bailout. And then if you continue past that screen, they're going to walk you through setting up your devices as trusted devices. And that basically involves sending a text message, a number, to your phone or your iOS device, and then you'll enter in that code on the website to confirm that you actually have physical access or physical control of that device. So it's going to display a list of any iOS compatible devices that you have registered with that Apple ID, and then you'll be able to set those up as trusted devices. It's also going to recommend that you set up a family member's or a spouse's device as a trusted device as well, just in case you lose yours. You can use that device to send the code to, and then that can validate that you have access to the account. So you'll set up all your trusted devices, and you just go through one by one. I would really recommend setting up multiples if you can, because that's going to be your backup if you lose one of your devices. You'll be able to do that. Of course, you're also going to have what you get in the next step, which is your recovery key as your sort of final backup. And this is the final confirmation screen. It's going to generate this 14-digit recovery code, and it's going to ask you to print it out and store it in a secure location. And this is very important. It's very important that you keep this code and that you don't lose it. I would actually maybe print multiple copies and store it in multiple locations. And Apple says do not store it on your computer. And I would say generally that is a good recommendation. I actually added mine as a PDF. I did a PDF printout and added it to my 1Password, as well as added it to my secure disk image. So I have a copy in a secure disk image that's stored on my computer. I also have a copy in 1Password, which is synced up with my Dropbox. My 1Password database is synced through my Dropbox, so I actually have multiple accounts of that. It's also backed up in my computer backups. But the important thing here is that in both those instances, the data is encrypted. So when I'm not logged into Dropbox and not logged into my account, it's stored in an encrypted file, and no one's going to be able to get in there and get at that recovery code, at least not very easily. And that's the whole point, is you want to protect that recovery code, because someone with physical access to that could potentially get into your account. But again, they're going to need physical access. So take that thing, print it out, put it in a safe, put it in your safe deposit box, wherever you think it might be kept securely. And then once you've done that, it will ask you for a final confirmation. You have to re-enter the recovery code. And I think Apple's doing that to so that you can prove that you actually have a printout of it, you have a copy of it. And Apple does not allow you to copy and paste it on the screen. So you actually do have to type that 14-digit code in. And once you've done that, you continue on, you agree to the final terms and conditions, and then you'll have two-factor authentication enabled. And at that point, there's no going back. You now have two-factor, but that really is, as I was saying, a good thing. And so now that you have it enabled, the next time you go to the Apple ID site to manage your account and you try and log in, you'll put your username and password in, and then it will pop up and it'll ask you which trusted device you want to send the 4-digit code to. You select whichever device you have on you at the moment, hit send, it will send you the code, and then you'll have to type that into the website before it will let you get in and access your account. So only you are going to be able to access and do things like change your password, manage your account information and stuff like that. And also, I believe when you go to make a new purchase on a new device or a new computer through iTunes, you're also going to have to verify your account or verify that that's a trusted device by entering in a 4-digit code that it's going to send to one of your devices. So two-factor authentication, very good thing, and I would encourage almost everybody to go in and enable it for your Apple IDs. I've been hearing reports from both you, and then this week I read on 9to5 Mac that there seems to be some pretty extensive issues being reported by a number of Retina MacBook Pro owners about problems with their displays. As a matter of fact, there's an over 500-page Apple support thread with users discussing various issues and potential solutions related to Retina MacBook Pros. And I have to imagine that if you're one of those customers that has an affected unit, that this is a pretty frustrating thing. So I wanted to mention it, and I also wanted to open up the conversation for maybe potential fixes or workarounds, or just to share stories about what issues you've been having and how either you or hopefully you and Apple helped resolve some of the issues. Now, there's a number of different things going on, so you may be impacted by one or the other, or maybe, hopefully not, but maybe multiple of these issues. But the most well-known is the one being the ghosting or residual image issue. I reported on this on a previous MacCast, but basically, this issue is believed to be something related to the LG manufactured displays almost exclusively, although I think there are some reports of users who say they have Samsung panels that are also exhibiting the phenomenon. And in case you don't know how to tell which panel you have or which manufacturer made your panel, there's actually a terminal command you can run to determine which display you have. And I'll have that command in the show notes at maccast.com. So if you just head to the website, find the blog post for this episode, and then click the show notes link. It'll say show notes in HTML. Click on that, and you'll find that code. You can just copy and paste it into the terminal. The command, you can copy and paste into the terminal and find out which manufacturer makes your display. And of course, you know, as happens with any kinds of issues of any significance, there's now a class action lawsuit over this issue. So it definitely is a problem, although the severity of it probably varies depending upon your perspective. Apple actually admitted the issue. They posted a tech support article. I'll also link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. It's called Avoiding Image Persistence on Apple Displays. And while you as a owner of one of these displays might consider it to be a serious flaw, Apple actually claims the behavior is quote-unquote normal for IPS displays, that when you have a fixed image on the screen for a long period of time, you can get this image ghosting left over. And what they recommend is that you set your display sleep to go to sleep in a relatively short amount of time. They recommend 15 minutes or less. And they also say that if you've wound up with one of these persistent images, you can actually wipe it away or clear it off by running your screensaver for approximately as long as the image was being displayed. So if you had that image up there for 30 minutes, then just run your screensaver for 30 minutes and it should wipe it clean. And they also said if you are setting up your screensaver, that you want to make sure that you set the display sleep time to trigger after the time period needed to wipe the residual image off your display. And then once it's cleaned up, what you probably want to do is go back and set your display sleep to go to sleep within 10, 15 minutes, something like that. And I think that's a good general recommendation anyway. I like to have my display go to sleep if it's been idle for a while, because I also go into the security settings and set the requirement to require a password when waking for sleep. That way, if I walk away from my machine, I know that nobody's going to be able to get in there and sort of mess with my stuff. So it's just one of those added layers of security that we've talked about in the past as well. Unfortunately, though, the image persistence problem, whether you believe Apple or not, is not the only problem being reported for the Retina MacBook Pro. There's also been reports of graphics-related issues affecting performance, causing frequent freezing or crashing of the MacBook Pro. Users have reported screen flickering in some cases. Also, there have been instances where people say their fans will spin up to maximum and back down, so erratic fan problems, wake from sleep issues, and some users are also reporting significantly reduced battery life. Now, it's not clear if these issues are isolated or completely unrelated, but they definitely are listed in that 500-page Apple support thread in all different forms. And beyond the one tech info article on image persistence, so far it seems that Apple's been relatively quiet about the Retina MacBook Pro issues. Now, some customers have reported that they've gone to the Apple Store or called up AppleCare to complain, and they're actually getting replacements or repairs done under AppleCare. But many of them are also reporting that when the systems come back or they get their replacement system, they end up with the same issues. And there's even some extreme cases where users have reported having their systems replaced 8 or even 9 times before they get an acceptable model. So that could be really annoying and frustrating. So this is definitely something that Apple's going to have to address, and they might have already addressed it with a couple of different things. A couple of weeks ago, Apple did release a firmware update for the MacBook Pro with Retina. MacBook Pro Retina SMC 1.1 update came out. You can get it through Apple's support website or through running the software update on your Mac, and it supposedly addresses graphics problems, issues with PowerNap, supposed to address the fan speed issues, and some users report that the updates did work for them, but still others are reporting that it didn't address their issues. So seems like there's so far been mixed results on running the firmware update. Another thing that Apple did recently was they quietly revved the MacBook Pros last month. You may remember I told you that they had bumped up the processors on those units. Well, additional teardowns show that the internal components look like they've also been upgraded. Things like the SSD, the I/O board, and the logic board, even the bottom case, received new parts updates. So it's not clear at this point whether or not these internal changes will address any of the reported issues, but I think it sounds like it would be likely that maybe some of the newer units, the most recently produced ones, the ones made in the last month or so, might address some of these hardware issues. But beyond reading the threads and looking for possible solutions, I would recommend that anyone experiencing these issues at the very least contact AppleCare through the phone or send them an email or something like that, or even just make an appointment, go into the Genius Bar and have your system looked at, analyzed, and potentially repaired and replaced. You might have to do it multiple times, and it might be really frustrating, but you know, considering a MacBook Pro with Retina is a pretty expensive laptop, it's a pretty big investment, you should have a system that works properly and functions properly. And so I would go in and get that thing replaced and addressed, at least get it in the system so that when Apple does issue fixes, they know how to contact you and they know that you have one of the affected units and they can better take care of you. But at this point, you might prepare yourself for multiple sessions, and as frustrating as that might be. And it's kind of sad to see that Apple is not living up to their normally high standards in terms of putting out new units. Every once in a while, it seems like we get a batch of Macs, a certain series or line of Macs that has these kind of problems. And it may just be that the Retina MacBook Pros, it's a relatively new technology, especially on the display side. We know they've had yield problems in the past, and they're having supply chain problems, so they've enacted multiple suppliers, and it sounds like they need a little bit of help getting the kind of quality control and production under control. So hopefully they've got that sorted out, or will relatively soon, and everybody can be happy with their new Retina MacBook Pros. But if you've experienced any of these issues or problems and you want to share your stories, you just need an outlet to vet, send your audio comments, your emails along to maccast@gmail.com, and I'm happy to listen. So here's a little interesting scenario. Have you ever had a personal iMessage pop up in a notification on your lock screen when you've been sitting in a public venue, looked and then realized that maybe that was something that you didn't want to share with everybody around you, or the person who just casually glanced over at your device because it made a noise? Yeah, that's never happened to me either. Okay, actually it has. You know, we all do these things, right? I leave my iPhone out on the table when I'm at my user group meeting, and there's, you know, people sitting to the right or left of me, and they have very easy access to look right at my screen. Now, luckily, I've never had anything too bad show up, but do I really want the person next to me reading personal messages, say, from my wife? I probably don't. Well, luckily, it's relatively easy to keep those notifications private, but still be able to receive a notification to know you've got a message. So if you open up settings on your iOS device and then tap on notifications and then messages, scroll down and you will see a show preview toggle. And if you simply just tap and turn that off, then it will not show the actual message in the lock screen. That's it. You will still get a pop-up. It will reveal who the message is from, but it will not show what it says on the lock screen. You'll actually have to unlock the app and then go into the messages to see your actual message. Now, the one thing it may do is expose the email address that it was sent from if it was sent via iMessage, but at least the person next to you is not going to be able to snoop in on your conversation. And if you don't want message alerts to show up at all on the lock screen, you could simply go into the notifications under messages and make sure that view in lock screen is set to off if you want to turn it off completely. So that's how you can keep your private messages private. And then finally for this week, I am going to let you in on an issue that I've been struggling with for the past week, and I'm guessing that some of you have been struggling with as well. Since upgrading to Mountain Lion, I've been having this problem where I keep getting duplicate applications showing up when I use the Open With contextual menu. So if I click on a document in the Finder, control click or right click on that document and go to the Open With option, you get that pop-down list of all of the applications that you can open that file with, and I have a ton of duplicate applications in there. And it's really frustrating. That list is actually created by something on your Mac called the Launch Services Database. So when I saw that, I knew that I had multiple entries somehow that had worked their way into my Launch Services Database. So I needed a way to be able to reset that. And where those are coming from in my case is I think it's actually picking them up from my super duper clone backup. And in OS X Lion, I thought I was able to avoid that from happening by making sure that in my Spotlight index, My backup drive is not set to be indexed by Spotlight. So I went into System Preferences, I went into Spotlight, and I made sure that I checked on, or that I clicked on the Privacy tab, and I added the backup volume to the privacy list. And that basically tells Spotlight, hey, don't index this volume. And I had done that not only on my Lion machine, but I also did set that up on my Mountain Lion machine. But that doesn't seem to be preventing those from working their way into my launch services database. So if you happen to know a way to prevent, and I did some Googling on this and I couldn't find anything, to prevent applications from ending up in the launch services database, let me know how to do that. But in my case, I knew that I needed to clear that out to reset it, and there is a way you can reset it using a series of terminal commands. So again, I'll have the terminal commands you need in the show notes at maccast.com. But once you have the terminal commands, you might consider taking those and creating, say, an Automator application so that you can just have the application, you can double click it and have it run the commands for you. Automator actually has an action that will let you run a shell script, which is basically what the terminal commands are. You chain them together. And you can access that from the utilities section of the library list in the Automator application. So just fire up Automator, say you want to create a new application, add the run shell script action, paste in this series of shell scripts or terminal commands, and then save that out, and you'll have a little application you can run to clear out your launch services database whenever you need to. And I've found that I'm needing to do it multiple times. So as I was doing this research, I also found a recent article from Sean Doc Boyd over at the Unofficial Apple Weblog. And, you know, I guess there must be multiple people having this issue because it popped up as this recent article. And I think Jeff Gamet actually over the Mac Observer also recently wrote an article related to this. So I don't know what's going on, if it was something triggered by a recent Apple update or what have you, but I'm definitely not the only one having this issue. But in Sean's article, he recommends actually taking the commands and putting them into a bash shell alias. And that way you can just do a simple command at the command line. You don't have to type the whole thing out or copy or paste it. You can just create a command that's easy to remember that you can just run, because you're probably going to have to run this multiple times. As I was saying, I'll clear it out and then suddenly the duplicates will start showing back up, and I don't know how to stop that. The other thing that Sean Boyd recommends in his article is maybe taking the commands and turning them into an Alfred workflow. So if you use Alfred, that would be a good way to go. If all of this just seems too complicated and you don't want to deal with shell scripts, you can actually use a GUI tool like Cocktail or Onyx. They both have the feature and capability of being able to reset the launch services database. And that's the key. You just want to reset the launch services database, and that will clear any duplicates out of your OpenWith menu. So if you've run into that, there's a couple of options for fixing it. And with that, that is going to do it for the MacCast for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software and get more information and details over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also PDF Pen for the iPhone and the iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch. You can get more information and details, as well as free trials of their Mac applications over at smilesoftware.com. GoToMeeting by Citrix. You can try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Just visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code MACCAST. Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, MacBook, Samsung Galaxy S, or other smartphone is worth over at gazelle.com. Squarespace, the beautiful and intuitive website publishing platform that lets anyone easily create a professional web page, blog, online store, or gallery, all in a single platform. You can try it free. Just go to squarespace.com/maccast and sign up now. And when you make a purchase on a new account, you can get 10% off when you use the offer code MACCAST3. Squarespace.com slash MacCast and ShareFile by Citrix. Take all of the hassle out of sharing and sending your business files via old methods like email attachments and FTP with ShareFile. You can try it risk-free for 30 days. Just go to sharefile.com, click on the radio microphone, and enter my offer code MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thank you to you for your support, for staying subscribed and listening. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. Leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype name is The MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, it's twitter.com/maccast, or be sure to check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. That'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.